What, you may ask, has the Vietnamese War got to do with origins of modern Britain? Very good question. You may not have asked it at all, of course, but what I intend to do over the next 35 to 40 minutes is really start addressing a couple of key areas, not only the transatlantic influence of America, which is very much at the heart of so much of what we've talked about in terms of how we came to be where we are now, both journalistically and as a culture, but also some of the other areas that really led to a reaction against these particular aspects. Last week, of course, we were looking at that selection of angry young men, self-styled angry young men, who would often be seen as folk who would intrinsically reject American influences. Although, as we saw in the case of the character Jimmy Porter, he might embrace aspects such as jazz, whilst rejecting, obviously, the overt consumerism and so on. But ultimately, as Hoggart, as Amis, as other writers actually argued, one of the key concerns that they actually had as writers at the time was that American consumer culture was undermining traditionally British values. Somehow there was a sense that British culture, as we knew it in the pre-Second World War and pre-Great War period, would ultimately disappear. It would disappear under the pressure of what would be seen as American consumerism. And even worse than that, American throwaway culture. This sense of disposableness. Remember, America as we know it today was literally just in existence for a couple of hundred years. 250 or so now, 1776. And even more so, literally just 100 years prior to the 1950s, was engaged in civil war over the abolition of slavery, amongst other things. So it was a relatively new environment, a new culture that had emerged as a global power on the world stage. However, it's all very well criticising American culture, and as you can see by the opening slide there, you've got the kind of classic notion of an American themed bar with clearly American branding in terms of Coca-Cola and so on. But in many ways, these writers were as much a product of American influence as the young people in the coffee bars whom they apparently despised so much. How do you actually separate the notion when you've got an all-pervasive American theme, American dream that's developed within that whole concept? Well, as is so often the case, it starts with the S word, science. And in particular, the social sciences. If you've gone off to university to study mathematics or engineering or physics or chemistry, that's very much a hard science. In terms of the softer areas, these are referred to as the social sciences. Economics, psychology, sociology, political science. All of these subjects came to prominence in the United States during the 1930s. And again, let's ask that question, why? Why did we actually feel, or why did higher education in the United States believe that these were worth studying and needed to be studied? And why in particular in the 1930s? In the immediate aftermath of the Wall Street crash, and in the immediate aftermath of, obviously, the Great Depression and a whole variety of other areas. If you ever want to read two very entertaining texts, some of you may have already come across these, about that particular time of American history. Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, or indeed Of Mice and Men, Of Mice and Men being a much shorter version by John Steinbeck, and also Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. You've got the two sides of American culture, huge consumerist success and a complete disaster when it all goes wrong. And that's really at the heart of trying to explain what the flip has gone on. Why have we actually got this stage where a country that was supposed to be getting better and better and better and better suddenly has this massive economic crash, and effectively, far worse than the dot-com bubble of the 1990s, creates a situation where whole lives are ruined and a whole range of problems are actually there Was this the beginning of the American nightmare as opposed to the American dream? Well, as ever, human beings being human beings, trying to find out an answer why was seen within the social sciences. And through a combination of research and statistics, it was felt if you could quantify the data and find sufficient facts about the whole thing, you would actually not only gather valuable information, but it would also hopefully prevent these instances from ever occurring again. So that politicians who were trying to counter the worst economic and social effects of the Great Depression would actually have some way of actually saying, well, this is how we do it. If we actually employ this kind of behaviour, this is what we actually do. In other words, if you can find out how society works, then you can change it just as you can change a machine. If you're making cars for Ford, or you're making machines and so on, if something goes wrong, you can fix it. So isn't society like that as well? Can't you actually just adjust it if it goes wrong? And that's at the heart of, again, the beginnings of this whole social science movement, which again, obviously still exists and permeates our society at present. This sense that science and public policy, in other words, the implementation of the findings of science, would effectively enable people to plan, and it would change everything for the better. And inevitably, America being America, and being founded on, again, a consumerist movement, this has also got an impact in terms of selling things. Because if you're actually analysing people's behaviours, you're analysing how they respond to various messages, you might well be able to find out how can you sell people things that make them purchase more things. How can they actually work on that basis? And so from the 1930s onwards, we also see a large number of private companies in America who also start employing psychologists to check the morale of their workers, to engage in things like time and motion studies, to test their characters, to use psychometric testing to find out if they're the right kind of individual, etc. In other words, getting the best results needed in order to not only organise workers, but also to control them and also control the products they produce. And then the next stage, of course, how can you actually best promote those to the general public? Okay, so that's taking place in America pre-World War II. Post-World War II, these ideas begin to get exported. They begin to come across the Atlantic from the notion of the British not only demanding more university courses, but also seeing that there are greater numbers of middle-class students who actually wanted to go to university and study and learn new skills. In addition to, obviously, the arts-based courses we've talked about, they wanted to train for jobs in planning, so town planning, various sort of ways of how you can actually set things up there, adult education, public policy, social services, and so on. If you've established the National Health Service, you need to have an infrastructure and managers who will effectively manage that service and work through the process. That ultimately created a whole new generation of young British graduates in the 1950s and also the early 60s and arguably 70s and 80s as well, who would have as kind of general broad characteristics the notions of reading and liking Kingsley Amis, listening to jazz, and going to cinema to watch new wave films, which may or may not be British, American, French, or other. And the other key influence that comes across, as we can see there by the model kitchen, which is often rejected by some British intellectuals, is the whole notion of consumerism. Again, I've trivialised this in the past, but it's worth as a catch-all phrase. You buy things to feel better. If you still feel bad, you buy more things, like more stuff. Keyword is buy. And remember the brand. It's an interesting sort of image that we see there, which we don't talk about again in terms of seminars. Banner headline, world's highest standard of living. Subtext, there's no way like the American way. It's a matter of controversy in terms of whether this image was actually posed, because if you compare the ethnic origin of the people in the car with those of the people who are actually in the bread line queuing for their soup kitchen and various other bits and pieces, you see a distinctive difference there. And I'm not going to insult your intelligence by saying, ooh, yeah, it's right. But there is a kind of message there in terms of where the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant or WASP notion is very much at the top of the American hierarchy. And by the beginning of the 1950s, American industry was thriving, but actually it had been beginning to grow and expand, with a few glitches as we'd said, throughout the first five decades of the 20th century. Factories would be pouring out goods. They'd be making lots of stuff. They'd be making vacuum cleaners, cooking machines, washers, exporting them, and so on. The stock market would soar. Credit was easy to come by. Companies would promote their new goods through advertising campaigns, and they'd also go on to use the same techniques that war propagandists actually use to actually promote their material. You know, repeat something often enough, people will start believing it again and again and again and again. Well-worn phrase. There were a range of labour-saving and luxury goods which would hit the main streets of initially America and latterly the world. Things like telephones, vacuum cleaners, washing machines, and of course cars, all being part of the lifestyle, the aspirational lifestyle. And indeed, obviously, in the 1950s, the television would also interconnect with that. And this is all being fuelled by a range of American movies, a range of advertising campaigns, all of which would carry images of the ideal lifestyle, the ideal American way of life, at least the ideal American way of life for the idealized middle classes all over the world. In other words, if you were looking to aspire to anything within the middle to the latter part of the 20th century, then conceivably it would be that of middle-class Americana. Middle-class Americans would primarily consider that their standard of living wasn't just a privilege, it was a right. It was a right that was enshrined in their constitution, a right to pursue liberty and happiness. And that became equated with a right to consume. So you see a distinctive shift here in terms of the ideological structure. A shift from the point of view of Wall Street and the money men to the advertising industry of Madison Avenue. Somehow, having been through the Depression and having seen the problems that actually occurred within the post-Depression environment in America, where again the country was in deep recession, there was a sense that actually Obama also tapped into in his presidency in this century to say that ultimately you need to spend your way out of the recession. You need to have confidence. How do you do that? Well, you actually shift the position of power from just being economically based and based on credit and so on to advertising. And the series Mad Men, if you want to binge watch it, is an ideal sort of way that actually sort of demonstrates that. In other words, it's aiming for a democratic capitalism. It's aiming for a fairer distribution of wealth in which everyone, every citizen, can have their own home, can have their own fridge, can have their own car, and as a result of that, everybody will be happier. Additionally, there's a whole range of building material. Construction industry work becomes very popular. I mean, America had not had the demolition that we'd suffered in Europe, but it was still building an awful lot of material. Building appliances also were fueling the American dreams, as we said. The whole notion of magazines like Life, Better Homes and Gardens, Good Housekeeping, all the kind of ideal. It's no good actually simply recycling. You want new, you want the newest, newer, better, best, and so on. And this ideal family in the ideal home, you can look at most American movies at the time. You can even look now, the bulk of American television still focuses on the family, even if it's a dysfunctional family. You still get that as the prime sort of notion, in which family life, the television, the patio, the barbecue, vacations, the cars, the appliances, it's all kind of built into that notion of this is what you should have. Filmmaker Terry Gilliam, went on to actually work with the Monty Python Brigade, often said that when he was growing up in America, he had all these images of life. And when he found himself actually one moment actually wandering around a beach with his girlfriend, so I thought, was he genuinely happy, or was he actually in a position that kind of the media had said he should be happy because that's what he's in? get into sort of existential crisis, which again we can talk about. How was this all fueled? Well, fueled quite literally and metaphorically, because energy was cheap. You know, gasoline was extremely inexpensive. You're looking at basically the equivalent of a shilling a gallon or something on that sort of basis. Now, again, it hasn't sort of improved, it hasn't sort of changed too much from that point of view. Obviously, in Britain, we still pay extensive sums of money just to tax our fuel. But that was all working, and the American dream, arguably, was coming to fruition. But, as with all things, there are changes. And by the time we reach the 1950s, world wars have ended, but America's oil is seen as a beginning to run out, as finite resources. So oil begins to be imported from the Middle East, and the Middle East will put up oil prices. And you've also got a situation whereby if you are in the White House, or in the House of Representatives, or the Senate, and you're in the government of America, actually you're spending so much on the defence of your country that you're also building up enormous debt. So, you've got a problem. How do you actually fuel that debt that you're building up to ensure that you can still keep the country moving to an ever prosperous future? You start dealing with exports. And you start exporting the American model of democratic consumption. In other words, it's essential to make sure that your American goods, from Coca-Cola to Chevrolets to Vauxhall to Fords, are exported globally if the American economy isn't going to collapse. By the 1950s, the influx of American ideas and American goods is also beginning to change the look of Britain. So you get, as we've frequently said, coffee bars, fizzy drinks, Coca-Cola, Pepsi and so on, jukeboxes, American music, American films and American fashion all flooding the market. Critics will be arguing that American culture is destroying British culture. People are watching American films. They're going to see the latest, you know, Elvis Presley or Marilyn Monroe movies, as opposed to, you know, the heart-rending work of John Osborne, Look Back in Anger, and so on. There's a new fashion that's sort of coming across, and people would actually be looking to America as their source of inspiration. They'd lose touch with their own past, their own identities. In other words, American values were seen as destroying British values. And people were trying to purchase happiness with a new fridge, with a new fashion, instead of actually looking for deeper personal happiness. Again, these ideas again keep emerging and re-emerging consistently as we actually see the cultures developing and working through that. But ultimately, it's seen that the right to consume in inverted commas, is not actually what life should be about. That American aim of exporting capitalism and democratic consumerism is not for everybody. This is before we even start talking about the huge ideological opposition of the Soviet Union and China. But perhaps we're wrong in actually painting America as the demons in this, the Machiavellian people who are actually saying, let's export our way of life to get ourselves more prosperous and so on. Because it's fair to say that there was a genuine belief in America that exporting the best type of society and giving others the right to participate in the American way of life was actually good. The zeal of the newly converted. Actually, what's wrong with wanting to actually have a democratic model of capitalism? Even though if America is going to prosper, it needs to actually avoid major issues such as this. And Uncle Sam, riding the good ship USA, heading off there, is faced with a potential disaster. It's a fly in the ointment. And quite literally, from this particular magazine, again the headline, The Red Iceberg, it's showing not only the allusion to the Titanic, but also the very fact that it's the tip of the iceberg is all that we can actually see. And what do we see here but tombstones? Tombstones of East Germany, Czechoslovakia, North Korea, Hungary, Poland, and China. Why tombstones? Well, they're all communist countries. They're all under oppressive totalitarian regimes. They're all, in essence, completely the antithesis of the American dream, And if you ever wanted to have any notion of the Red Menace, there's the hammer and sickle, this notion of communism, something which couldn't be further from that individuality that's being preached and practiced by the American way of life. This is a notion where the state controls everything. It's the state apparatuses of control that effectively works on that basis. Ultimately, this is simply a competing view. This is a competing socio-economic model. It's actually using the same kind of science that America's using to export its way of life, but there's a big contrast. And that communism developed under, obviously, Karl Marx, and then applied through Lenin, through Stalin, through Mao Zedong, and so on, was seen very much as another alternate view, but another way which was better for all. Communists primarily believed that production should be owned and controlled by the state. So that notion of the individual, and celebrating the individual, gone completely. Society should be classless. It shouldn't be based on consumption. It should simply be based on the needs of the individual. Now, after the Second World War, the Soviet Union occupied most of Eastern Europe. This was historically set up at Yalta, whereby basically the continent was carved up into two major segments. As we said, places like Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, etc., all sliced off and kept separate and looked after under the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Always important. Russians today will say, that's nothing to do with us Russians. It was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics who were kind of dominating from that side of things. China itself had undergone a communist revolution. And communists, like Americans, wanted a world modelled on their own system. So it's not enough to actually just say, well, okay, in China we're staying communist. No, we want to export communists to the world. Fine, until you actually start dealing with how do people impact on that. So what's the consequence of having these two extreme ideologies? And Britain, right in the middle, thinking, where the hell do we go? Probably America. Well, you've actually got the Cold War. You've got the Cold War primarily because, in the case of the USSR and America, with both people actually having access to nuclear weaponry, to actually go and heat up the war, you're talking mutually assured destruction. It's never in the interests of either the USSR or the USA to go to war once they actually had nuclear technology, unless you are completely insane. So what do they actually do? They settle for this ideological war. They settle for propaganda. Lenin, actually, before the Second World War, had actually said, if I only had control of Hollywood, the whole world would be communist within months, paraphrasing his actual line. But actually, if you look at the USSR, the film industry with Eisenstein and so on, they were actually not film studios, they were film factories. They're producing material which is very much designed to propagate and use propaganda to influence people's beliefs and dreams and so on. So you've got this situation where neither the USA nor the SSR, can't actually fight a war directly, but they can get involved in what is right the way back to what we talked about in week one, are called proxy wars. Wars in which you encourage other people to take on board arguments and irritations for your own sake. The first one being the Korean War between 1950 and 1953. Some figures. There were 2 million civilian casualties and nearly half a million casualties amongst the Allies in South Korea. And that included troops from the USA, from the United Kingdom, from Canada and Australia. North Korea apparently suffered 1.5 million casualties, but that also included Chinese troops who were working with North Korea and Soviet advisors. It's hard to be definitive about those figures because many actually still were missing in action at the time and records weren't kept to, shall we say, the level that the Nazis had kept in the Second World War. During the 1950s and 1960s, nevertheless, the Cold War became a fact of life. Again, thinking about where we're coming together, the notion of living under the shadow of the bomb in Britain was very much a matter of fact. You can see it again represented in films and television programmes of the time. There was a clear binary divide between the East and the West, between communism and between capitalism. And the main arenas for ideological and military intervention, in other words, proxy wars between the superpowers, were the areas that we now refer to as third world countries. Countries, effectively, which had formerly been run by European empires, like France or Britain, but effectively had gone independent or sought their own independence. And the European empires had effectively crumbled, and there was a general fear that as nature abhors a vacuum, the Soviets or the communists would take in and take over these countries, leading to problems. And one of those countries was the French colony of Indochina. Indochina was comprised of Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. Now, during the Second World War, the Japanese occupied Indochina. By the time they leave, having lost the war, of course, there was a revolutionary movement that sprung up in Vietnam. And that movement had the aim of ending colonial control, so telling the French to go forth and be fruitful, and to seek a new life for the population. The French, obviously not willing to give up their colony, wanted to try and regain the colony, but they didn't have the military might to do so. So they wanted to actually enlist American backing to help them. So why, if you were in the White House and you were following through Eisenhower's plan, or you were looking at the sort of notions of that as president, why would you wish to help the French take part in Vietnam? You don't even speak the French language, for God's sake. Okay, arguably you could say, well, the French Revolution, the tricolour, life, liberty and happiness, kind of act as a precursor to the American Revolution, so there were historical elements there. But why would you have that French-American bonding? Well, put simply, because of fear. Because of fear of what we would actually regard now as, and then, as being the domino effect. Domino theory, in terms of geopolitics, states quite simply and effectively that if one country falls to communism, then it'll undermine another country. China had already become communist in the years immediately following the Second World War, and so had North Korea. Obviously, it had led to the Korean War. So this ideology of communism was beginning to spread. And so, as one country becomes communist, it's a bit like an infection. Suddenly another country is infected. And so, as you can see there, if they didn't do anything to stop this, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Malaysia, India, all the way through India, might suddenly become countries to which you could not sell American goods because they would not want you. You would be told, Yankee, go home. Big problem. And yet you can't engage in any serious hot warfare in terms of bombs because of the consequences. Indochina was rich in rice, it was rich in rubber, it was rich in coal, it was rich in iron ore, it was also the gateway to markets and commodities in Southeast Asia. Losing that gateway would be a massive threat to American interests. So the response was that America would funnel in billions of dollars, to bolster the French. And when the French actually pulled out, they put in their own particular puppet ruler. Saddam Hussein? No, that was Iran. That was another thing in the 1980s, 1990s. No, but what they actually did was they actually put in their own choice of ruler, undemocratically elected, but somebody who effectively would take an American viewpoint. Somebody called Diem. Now, you might well sort of think, okay, you've put in a puppet ruler called Diem. He's not actually featured there. I'll come on to Ho Chi Minh in a few moments. But there's a big problem. Number one, Diem, D-I-E-M, is a Catholic. Okay, what's the problem? Well, the predominant religion for Vietnam is Buddhism. Diem was also somebody who was very much pro the landlords and against the peasants. And his response to criticism was quite simple: imprison critics or shoot them. Bit of a problem there, in a diplomatic line. And it obviously led to, again, a sense of revolution. Communists in the north would actually gather around Hanoi as the centre of government, a new leader led by Ho Chi Minh. In 1960, rebels in the south, under American control, formed the National Liberation Front, which was called the Viet Cong. What else is happening in 1960? You have a new president elected. A new, young, dynamic president, who we've already commented on in his meeting with Harold Macmillan, John F. Kennedy. Kennedy still supports Diem. He also supports American involvement in the region of Vietnam. So what have you got? You've got a situation where North Vietnamese interests and the Viet Cong are basically the Sutton United to America's arsenal, without the pie eaters. But basically, they're taking on the greatest military superpower in the world. Is it going to be a case like Suez? Are they going to win? Could they do it again? Obviously, Suez was the British Empire. This is the American scenario. The answer was no. The Vietnamese had a long tradition of challenging occupation. If you were a Vietnamese citizen, you had, at various times over the years, been occupied by the Chinese, by the French, by the Japanese. So actually going up against a dominant ideology was almost a kind of national way of life. And there was also a notion of heroes like Ho Chi Minh, who effectively would rally the troops, who would be seen as very much being part of a national cult way forward. Meanwhile, Diem, the Prime Minister installed with American help to look after the regime, is just not coping with any dissidents. As I said, his solutions is not great. And in June 1963, a few months before Kennedy's assassinated, a Buddhist monk is so annoyed, he sits down in the public square in Saigon and sets fire to himself, immolating himself in the protest march. Okay? Again, Buddhism, primarily a religion of peace and tolerance and so on, and it reached the stage whereby, you know, to kind of raise the issue of the total unpopularity, the Buddhist monk effectively sets fire to himself. And inevitably, this serves as the creation of a martyr. Diem's response to arrest more people, to set fire on protesters, to lose temples, all of this is bad publicity. You don't have to be a Wall Street marketeer to say this is not a good way of managing your reputation. This is embarrassing. If you've also started employing the Central Information Agency, or CIA, to actually work subversively in the country to encourage, you know, people to effectively sort of pursue the American way of life, it's even more problematic. Particularly if you're looking to support a military coup by the generals. What are the kind of numbers of American advisors who are now actually working in Vietnam in the early 1960s? 17,000. Quite significant, really. They're not there in any official capacity, but they're there in an advisory capacity to provide help, aid, advice, and so on and so forth. They can realise politically that Diem is effectively, he's lost the plot. And so they don't actually warn him about a political coup that's taking place. Diem, still believing he's got American support, spends a lot of time desperately trying to seek advice from America and so on, seek help. It's all ignored, and he ends up dead in the back of a truck. Again, not hugely unknown if we look at what happened latterly to other major American friends and countries, such as Saddam Hussein and indeed Libya's Colonel Gaddafi. But that's for another sort of period of time. And again, where do we sit in Britain with respect to that? Needless to say, Kennedy having been assassinated 3 weeks after Diem ended up being shot in the back of a truck, led to Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson not really knowing what the hell to do next. It's a problem. It's problematic. Lyndon B. Johnson, as you can see there on the left-hand side, looking heavenward, saying, what do we do now, is effectively in a situation where basically not only is he inexperienced, he's also not entirely in control of what's happening. Well, that's great. So we're in a situation here, if you're Harold Macmillan, Prime Minister of Britain at the time, whereby you know you're not going to be communists, but you know you don't want to trigger off the whole sort of nuclear scenario. You've got a Vietnamese situation which is looking more and more nightmarish on a day-by-day situation. because of being out of control, escalating into all sorts of other areas. Robert McNamara, Secretary of State for Defence, he is actually coming to this as an educated social scientist. So he, head in hands, is trying to see how can we actually apply sociological techniques to fix this problem. Because clearly what you've got in America, what you've got in Vietnam, is a problem that's impacting American interests and, by association, interests with other American friends across the world. So, what happens in 1965? All else fails, send in the troops, America starts a full-scale war in Vietnam. It's a disaster. By any stretch of the imagination, the American war in Vietnam becomes disastrous. By 1968, there are 500,000 American troops in Vietnam fighting a dirty guerrilla war. America actually dropped more bombs in Vietnam than all the Allied bombing in World War II. It used chemicals and napalm to destroy forest cover. Napalm itself, if you're not familiar with it, is a gasoline jelly that sticks to people and burns them alive. It's not a pleasant way to actually exist, as we can see by his children. Again, very famous war photograph that are sort of seen in terms of indiscriminate mass bombing. The American army would go after any dissidents in Vietnam in search and destroy missions where it was clear civilians may or may not support nationalism. And any guerrillas were often killed or taken away to refuge camps. This was, again, part and parcel of the solution that was meant to actually say, we'll restore good quality capital rule to South Vietnam and North Vietnam, and we'll get rid of the communist interests. In an episode entitled Operation Phoenix, the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, executed 20,000 civilians without trial. Why? Because they were suspected of being communist. Well, of course you would. Why not? In 1968, in My Lai, there were a detachment of Americans who were literally sent in on a search and destroy mission, who effectively killed between 450 and 500 women, children and elderly, lining many up in a ditch and shooting them. Why? Because war drives people crazy. How is this happening? How is this thing, which also we're seeing beamed into our houses through the medium of television on a daily basis, how are we effectively accepting this? What impact is this actually having? And what impact is it also having on Americans living in America? Well, as you might imagine, given that you have good and bad in most sides and ideologies, the war had a huge impact on the ordinary American citizen, particularly as the body bags came home, as they watched the war unfold on television. This was not the American dream that they'd been promised. This is human beings basically being mass slaughtered. Is it any surprise that people your age would take that attitude? Why would you actually want to sign up for an army to go over to a war that you didn't believe in, to be forced to shoot people that effectively their only crime apparently was supporting a different kind of ideology? Young men would increasingly refuse to register for draft. They would burn their draft cards in protest. They'd go to Canada. They'd do all sorts of other areas in order to actually get out of this whole notion. In San Francisco, 300 prospective draftees returned their cards in an anti-government protest. And by mid-1968, there were 3,000 prosecutions of people who refused to be drafted. This went up within 6 months from 3,000 to 34,000 in 1969. People were fed up with going for this whole notion of, again, a war situation. And if you think, does this not carry echoes of a certain sort of Gulf War I, Gulf War II, etc.? Well, maybe it does. But again, that's a discussion in seminars and so on. In 1967, there was a huge Pentagon demonstration by anti-war protesters. This, again, is happening at the same time as we'll see as there's another kind of cultural dynamic and revolution occurring within the 60s, within the period of time there, the gradual movement of what's referred to as flower power. You can see in this particular image the protesters actually coping with the military police by putting flowers in the gun barrels and so on. And clearly, from that whole perspective, we have a situation in which, you know, the problematics of the war were very much brought to the fore. And the Vietnam War actually still carried on until 1973. But, as we said, it was a disaster in most senses. It was a military disaster, it was a political disaster, and it was a social disaster. It cost $100 billion. And it also undermined America's self-belief. Vietnam, arguably, has still never recovered. I mean, I think it's easing slightly more into the 21st century. Overall, in terms of the numbers of the Vietnam War, there were 58,000 Americans who were killed, but that compares with between 3 and 4 million Vietnamese. So again, you have a lot of issues with respect to that whole process. But I say, at the heart of this Vietnamese War, in 1967, at home in the States, which again we're seeing in Britain through television, etc., there's a huge Pentagon demonstration by anti-war protesters, including the co-founder of the Youth International Party, Yippies as opposed to Hippies, a certain Abbie Hoffman. Hoffman's line was that, yes, he was very much against the Vietnamese War, get the hell out of Vietnam, as you can see there, but he also wanted to ensure that there were peaceful protests. Now, those peaceful protests did actually become slightly more violent, and we'll see also how they impacted in terms of European protests at the war as well, because this is obviously a war that's not playing well overseas with America in terms of its global position and so on. It also was a series of protests in which it wasn't just students and social activists who were protesting. In fact, by early 1968, ordinary people would become anxious about the war itself. In terms of the celebrity world, Muhammad Ali refused to serve, and his punishment was that his championship title for boxing was actually taken away by the authorities. In other words, this war that had been set up to prevent the domino effect, effectively because the puppet ruler hadn't actually worked, etc., was destroying belief in authority, and it actually led to millions of young people rejecting the values and behaviour of their elders. These were a mixture of students, but also young workers as well. And in an era where Timothy Leary, a Harvard social scientist, effectively coined the phrase with respect to drug experimentation, turn on, tune in and drop out, there was a sense that by 1968 the very foundations of American society seemed to be under threat. Things were going from bad to worse in Vietnam. Martin Luther King, who was campaigning primarily against poverty, was assassinated. And there were huge outbreaks of urban violence in the ghettos that were put down by soldiers. And shortly afterwards, in 1968, Robert Kennedy, brother of John F. Kennedy, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, seeking presidential nomination on an anti-war platform, was also assassinated. Not great. By August 1968, there were thousands of anti-war demonstrations, and there was a whole range of activities taking place in Chicago, in the Democrat conventions, in which city police were assaulted, and hundreds were being injured and so on. And then, at the end of the 60s, the sort of apocalypse of, or the apogee of flower power, etc., we have Woodstock. Woodstock was a great counter-cultural festival. This, however, became a national emergency when the roads to Woodstock, the first major pop festival, were blocked because there were so many people actually wanting to attend and so on. How does this relate to kind of geopolitics? Well, again, we'll draw some of those connections in future sessions. So all this protest from this war that started in 1965, that led through the Lyndon B. Johnson administration, that actually went through the sort of onset of Richard Nixon, etc., continued. It also reached a climax in 1970, when Nixon decided to actually sort of make another decision. Vietnam wasn't working out. What can we do? How can we solve it? Let's invade another country. So they invaded Cambodia. Genius. Kent State University in Ohio, there was a peace protest. A peace protest against the invasion of Cambodia. And we can see there Marianne Vecchio, who's actually a 14-year-old runaway, kneeling over the dead body of Jeffrey Miller. Because the response of the National Guard to this peaceful protest was to fire into the crowd. There were 9 injured, 1 paralysed and 4 killed. Again, violence begetting violence. The publicity that was given to student protests, to issues relating to that, to issues relating to the characters there who were all killed in, as you can see, the Kent State Ohio Massacre, as it was actually referred to, all kind of created this impression that there was a kind of revolutionary fervour in the air, that this middle-class, influential group of people were also supported by blue-collar workers and so on. Well, again, never quite as simple as that. In 1970, there were general polls taken which suggested that 65% were against the war in Vietnam. But because this was being beamed into people's ordinary homes on a regular basis, there was a whole range of opposition by soldiers and veterans on a scale never seen before. And there were also thousands of desertions which took place, which prevented, obviously, again, the notion of any sort of balanced analysis of what exactly is going on. How's it impacting Europe? Well, apart from the fact that soldiers in Vietnam actually started wearing armbands and badges that supported the peace movement, and apart from the fact that their morale was pretty low, and there were also 209 incidents of fragging that took place in 1970. In case you're wondering, fragging is when effectively you will roll a fragmentation bomb under the tent of a superior officer. A bit messy, but obviously it's illegal as well. It doesn't actually help morale too. We talked about the yippies, the hippies and so on. The protest movements would be predominantly seen as American phenomena. But those attitudes and fashions of protest would quickly spread to Europe. And this is actually taking place in London, a presentation again against the war. And we'll see again in terms of 1968, this revolutionary spirit, how again there are a range of other factors coming into the mix at this particular side of things. Is war a fashion? Is it seen as something in that? Well, maybe it's being funneled into that notion of change and adjustment. But fundamentally, that opposition to the Vietnamese War, why we kind of address it with respect to origins of modern Britain, was because it was certainly impacting. I think a number of people felt that we could raise a similar anti-war fervour with respect to recent activities this century. Maybe we still can. I don't know. That's again for debate. But by the later 60s, Vietnam, like everything American, you could argue, became an international issue. It bound together groups of protesters in a variety of countries, ironically some in France as well, who could have, in essence, said, wasn't for the French, who wouldn't have got into this in the first place. But it also helped to spread countercultural ideas. In other words, if you were against the war in Vietnam, maybe you were against some of the other so-called things which had remained static in society. Maybe you should be interested in things like racial equality, alleviating poverty, sexual freedom and equality, drugs, music, alleviating poverty. Maybe there was a chance to actually alleviate those aspects as well. We'll talk about that and its impact on Britain, and of course the other big question for origins of modern Britain, immigration, when we come back after Reading Week. And all I have to say now is if you're one of my group this afternoon who desperately wants to go to see the alumni affair, if you sign in your register here, then I'll take it as, well, you're around, but you're at the alumni event, if you desperately need to go to the alumni thing. Thanks for your time, and I'll see you, and on!